So we have two parshiot this week. One is Acharemot and the other is Kedoshim. So I know that sometimes when I do this, I'm a little guilty of making false assumptions or bad assumptions. And that is that as I'm talking, I just figure that you know, like all of Sefer Vayikra, which is really good that you know this. Acharemot, at least the first part of it, is about the avodah, the service which is done by the Kohen Gadol in the Beit HaMikdash on Yom Kippur. Now, the truth is, some of what I just now said was superfluous, because the only time the Kohen Gadol really functions as the Kohen Gadol is on Yom Kippur. He has the right to function whenever he wants, but it's not as the Kohen Gadol per se. It's just a Kohen works in the Beit HaMikdash. The day of the Kohen Gadol is Yom Kippur. Or, actually, the way it's pronounced in the Torah all the time is Yom Kippurim. It's always said in the plural, and it's never said in the singular. It's real interesting why we do. Maybe the first question is the other way around, is when it's plural, what is the plural indicating? What's the Kippurim about? But it is interesting that in our vernacular, it's Yom Kippur, and that's not the biblical terminology. So it starts with the work of the service of the Kohen Gadol, Yom Kippur. It moves over to types of idolatry, inappropriate chukim or service of non-Jews, and then it moves into a whole section of inappropriate sexual behavior. And that essentially is Acharemot. Now the first thing about Acharemot that we really should be asking ourselves, it starts off that God spoke to Moshe and Aaron, Acharemot Shnei B'nei Aaron, after the two sons of Aaron died, and that then leads you to an obvious question. So if this is after the two sons of Aaron died, why wasn't this just now said, right after the two sons of Aaron died? Now again, I'm sorry for this, but the two sons of Aaron died, they back in Parshat Shmini. Between Parshat Shmini and now, we had Tezri and Metzora, and there's a whole bunch of things that were accomplished during that time. By the way, this question that I'm asking, every single time I'll see my older brother, Yair, I'll see him this time of year. If the family gets together, he always asks this question. I don't know if he always gives the same answer, but he always asks this question. He likes... Excuse me? He wrote about this. Yeah, and he also wrote a whole book on Yom Kippur, right? I have a brother who's a famous rabbi, but then again, so does he. So let's then try to get back to this again. Tezriah and Metzora, which deal with lots and lots of other things, and by the way, the second half of Shmini is also the question, and we'll say hopefully that all this is part of the answer. The second half of Shmini introduces all kinds of laws of kosher. Which of the animals are kosher, the fish that are kosher, the birds that are kosher, and so on. So it's all the kosher things that are thrown in the second half of Shmini, and Tezri and Metzori gets into all kinds of laws of Tuma and Tahara, purity, impurity. And then Yom Kippurim. And then, again, before we get more specific, and we have a second parsha, which is Kedoshim. So Kedoshim, at face value, it's holiness. Which, of course, sets up for us a wonderful question. What exactly is holiness? Or, for that matter, how is holiness achieved? And it starts off, Kedoshim Tihyu, you shall be holy. As I said, that's a challenge. How in the world are we supposed to be holy? The second thing, which I'm going to add on to that question, or make a statement, I think modern society tells us that what we should ascribe to is to be a good person. What exactly is a good person probably is going to be more dependent on which part of the society you live in. For that matter, do you live on the East Coast or the West Coast or all that space in between? What exactly is a good person is probably very geographical and obviously chronologically determined. And it has changed. I mean, it's changed in my lifetime what exactly things are considered to be good or not good, and we'll leave it at that. But Judaism apparently is telling us that it's not enough to be a good person, and what God charges us with is a I'll call it a mandate now. Maybe it's a challenge. And that is to be holy as well. And I think holiness to a certain extent scares us. Because, you know, when somebody says, so what do you want to be when you grow up? I don't know how many of us are going to say, oh, I want to be holy. I just can't imagine that. Actually, probably what most of us more likely will say is anything but that. So that's also a challenge. The other thing about holiness that also needs to be said is that too many people will connect holiness with external trappings, which means if you would have gone to a yeshiva or a seminary during this year, so at this point of the year especially, the extent of external trappings that you would have accepted on yourself would have been a wonderful way to gauge how much you've succeeded this year in becoming holy. So if you put on a black hat, especially if you're a male, so that's, you know, this incredible success. If somebody starts to wear a gartel, or somebody starts to do, you know, a girl skirts, longer skirts, this kind of, and so on, without getting into all kinds of issues. Excuse me? At that point, a person has become religious. They're religious now. And maybe even they think that that's holiness. But unfortunately, the correlation between outward trappings and inner holiness is not always there. I'm not saying it's never there. I'm just saying is that if the individual thinks that their achievement is exclusively dependent upon some type of external factor, then they are not going to succeed. On the other hand, you know, in America today, there's a huge problem in terms of intermarriage. I mean, to be, you know, extremely honest on this, if you would track the population of Israel, or for that matter, when it was still Palestine, right, pre-1948, and going all the way till today, and you track the population of the United States from 1948 until today, you'll find that the population of Jews in America has pretty much stayed the same, fallen a bit, and part of the problem is even figuring out who to count. Because if you're not Orthodox, then the odds of you being Jewish, if you have a Jewish last name, decrease every single year because of the amount of intermarriage which takes place. So therefore, when you're going to approach a 50% intermarriage and your name is going to be a Jewish last name, so that's going to be a pretty good indication that you're not Jewish. While if your name is a not Jewish name and your mother's Jewish, that indication that you are Jewish. So now, how exactly do you stop intermarriage? So it could be that if you grow long payas and you wear a black coat, a long coat, and you know, maybe harder to pick up girls in bars. I don't know. Maybe girls are into that. Maybe that's also something to think about. But I think sometimes the outward trappings work because it's an expression of who I want to be, and it creates boundaries. There's no question it creates boundaries. And maybe there's something very good about that. But my point to what I was saying before, if that is the exclusive religiosity, that your hat is religious, or your coat is religious, your skirt is religious, and so on, so there's something missing. Because holiness is about something which is inside, I would say, far more than outside. If the outside succeeds in somehow representing what's inside, that's great. You know, there's a teaching about the going back to Shemini and the kosher fish. So the kosher fish all have fins and scales. So one of the questions is, so why? And then, by the way, there's no good answer to that. I just want you to realize there's no good answer to that. But a bad answer, which is really nice, is that kosher fish have fins and scales so they can swim against the stream. And Jews need to be able to swim against the stream. We need not just to be followed by whatever the current is going, wherever it's pulling us. We need the ability of going against what's being done sometimes, because we need our own inner voice which tells us what is right and what is wrong. So therefore, it's very symbolic. And I'll leave it. Excuse me? Yeah, but it's very symbolic. It's very symbolic about the kosher fish saying that you are what you eat, and therefore eat fish that have fins that are able to swim, because if they can swim, they can go against the current, and you're not just swept away like everybody else's, whatever winds are blowing and taking you in a particular way. So I said the symbolism is quite interesting. But once again, there is this charge for us to be holy. So to a certain extent, I would actually think the entire book of Vayikra is about holiness. That's what the book is. But we get fooled with it because when we go through the first 9-10 chapters or so, the major focus is the Mishkan. It's all Mishkan-centric, Mishkan-oriented. And then we get to Parshat Acharimot, and I'll skip the Tumah and Tahara for a moment, and we get to Parshat Acharimot, and we realize we went deep into the Mishkan, probably deeper than we ever go, and that is going into the Holy of Holies on the holiest day of the year. By the way, notice, I almost can't avoid the word holy now when I'm talking about Yom Kippur, holiest day of the year, Shabbat Shabbaton. It is the day that you go into the holiest place, and you go into the holiest place, into the deepest, holiest part of the holiest place, the Kodesh Kodashim. So therefore, you realize now that we are completely subsumed with holiness when it comes to Yom Kippur. So again, I want to pause here for a moment. Part of what happens, and this goes to your point about why is it called Yom Kippurim and not Yom Kippur, when you actually read the verses, you'll get quite surprised. Because when we think about Yom Kippur, it's all about one thing. I've messed up during the year. God, please forgive me. Give me atonement. Kippur is atonement. Kippurim, atonement. Give me atonement. Give me purity. Make me whole again. And give me another year to mess up again. That's essentially what Yom Kippur is. But when you start reading about actually the verses and what it says, that a good part of the atonement on Yom Kippur is not for us. It is for us ultimately, but it's not for us. We also seek atonement for desecrating that which is holy, namely the Mishkan. Which means a lot of the aspect, again, in the Torah, pshat level, is that Yom Kippur is about fixing the Mishkan because we may have misused the Mishkan. You probably want me to try to prove that point. I'm reading now from chapter Perek Tet Zayin, Pasuk Tet Zayin. So this would be 16:16. V'chiper al hakodesh, bring atonement for that which is holy. Mitumot b'nei Yisrael, from the Jews making the Mishkan tamei, impure as it were. U'mipishem l'chol chatotam v'chein yaseh l'oha moed, and do the same for the tent of meeting, part of the Mishkan. Hashochenitam b'toch tumatam, essentially telling us that you need to fix the Mishkan because you've misused the Mishkan. And that, by the way, itself is fascinating. And I want to go back again, at least on a metaphoric level, what that may be telling us. God gave us a Mishkan so somehow holiness can be in our midst. The first sin that we need to fix before we can fix anything else is by misusing this place which is holy. So the misuse of holy is the first problem that we have. By the way, it should not take a long time for us then to process, hold it. There's something else which God gave us which is holy, and that is our souls. Which means the human being, part of what I need to fix. I know that on one level, when I think about Yom Kippur, how do I think about it? I messed up, I did something wrong, I'm afraid of punishment, please forgive me. And what I'm asking you to think about this is in a completely different way. God, you've given me a pure soul. I have somehow taken that soul and sullied it. I've made it something which is impure. So the first thing I need to fix is to say to God, I'm sorry that I messed up on that which you gave me, which is holy, because I've turned this thing which is holy into something which is not holy. So once I've asked for forgiveness for that, then I can proceed and move on to the other points. So again, I'm going to say it's fascinating. And we miss this completely, unless you're a little obsessive and read every word carefully, to realize that a part of Yom Kippurim, of the various things which you're getting atonement for, is not just the human being, it's the misuse of what which is holy. And I'll say it one more time, that becomes a second metaphor for us, which is phenomenal. You know, God, I'm sorry that I've not used my capabilities. I'm sorry that the intellect that you've given me, I've not used this in a way. I'm sorry the soul that you've given me has become somewhat distant from me in the sense that I'm not in touch with it. And I go back to this point, so what do I want to be when I grow up? Well, maybe I want to be holy. That just sounds so crazy, but maybe not as crazy as we think. Yeah.
What does
atonement mean? Atonement. That's what I was thinking as well, is that now we no longer focus on the other areas of atonement. We no longer focus on the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash as well, so we only focus on ourselves. Incidentally, all the stuff in between that we skipped, all the things of Tazri and Metzora, and all the Tum'ah, which is mentioned there, and again, we don't have a good definition for Tum'ah. Tum'ah I would define as distant or inverse of holiness. Tum'ah is a situation whereby I can't enter the place which is holy because I have Tum'ah. There are different types of Tum'ah. In order to enter into this place, I need Tahara. Tahara is that which allows me to enter the Mishkan, and Tum'ah is that which doesn't allow me to enter into the Mishkan. And I'll tell you something which is interesting. In the Middle Ages, there were women who, when they were menstruating, would not walk into the Beit Knesset. There is no such halakha. It doesn't exist. Nonetheless, there was this sensitivity that hold it. This is some type of tum'ah, and that's some type of kedusha, and therefore I won't go in. By the way, the rumor that some of you may have heard at some point that a woman can't touch a Sefer Torah, right? It comes from the same tradition, which is not a halakha. It is rather something which is much more instinctual, but has nothing to do with halakha. Quite the opposite. You open up the Shulchan Aruch in Yaradeya, in the laws of Sefer Torah, it says, a Sefer Torah is not makabel tum'ah, a woman is allowed to touch a Sefer Torah. Anybody who tells you that the reason women don't dance with Sefer Torah on Simchat Torah is because a woman could have tum'ah, it's absolutely not true. It's I don't know how strong to say this. It's a lie. It's just not the case. Could there be other reasons? There could be all kinds of reasons that people can make. But if somebody makes that argument, it's just not a true argument. It goes completely against. Now, I'll say it again. Were there women who decided that they didn't want to enter into... Yeah, there are some women that if they are in Nidah and during Birkat Kohanim, then they'll turn around, which is also like completely bizarre to me. But it goes back to this inner sense of Tum'ah and Kedushah and how do you deal with it. But I'll say it again. All of this is imaginary. But when the Beit HaMikdash existed, and a Beit Knesset is not a Beit HaMikdash, when the Beit HaMikdash existed, then there were all types of tumot, by the way, that men would have and women would have, that meant that they could not walk inside the Beit HaMikdash. So therefore, tum'ah and all of these things, you know, you go back, you no matter what I say today, Rabbi Ben-Avi is going to keep on saying something about Nogden Avihu. He's just going to keep on going back there. He's stuck with... Yeah, but the main issue of tum'ah tahara is the issue of the Mikdash. And by the way, the Ravid would say that there's none at all whatsoever. He would completely agree with the way that I'm formulating it. So all of this stuff about Tazri and Metzora and all the various types of Tum'ah, that's what it is. That these people can't enter into the Mishkan, which then leads us back to the proper entry into the Mishkan, to the Holy of Holies, the Avodah of the Kohen Gadol, on Yom Kippur, and Kodesh HaKadoshim, Shabbat Shabbaton, and really in a certain sense, this is it's the apex. That's really what it is. But from this apex of atonement, forgiveness, it then goes into, as I said, the exact opposite. I mean, there's many opposites over here, but the opposite of not serving God in the Beit HaMikdash, but rather Avodah Zarah, and how to stay away from that. And then it goes into, as I said, this whole discussion about a list of all types of illicit sexual relations. Then it leads into Parshat Kedoshim. Now, Kedoshim is fascinating because when you look at the beginning of Kedoshim, which again starts with, God said to Moshe, Daber al kol kahal adat b'nei Yisrael. One second. Let's read it with precision rather than citing it without precision. Vayidaber Hashem Moshe lemor, Daber al kol adat b'nei Yisrael. Speak to the entire congregation of Israel, v'amarta aleihem, and say to them, kedoshim tihyu, you shall be holy, ki kadosh ani Hashem elokeichem, because I'm holy. By the way, I can just as easily get to the opposite conclusion. God is holy, how can I be holy? Actually, what does the word holy mean? So Rashi tells us the word holy means separate. So when we say that God is kadosh, 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 what are we saying? That God is separate, 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 or God is transcendent? So if God is completely transcendent, God is completely holy, how can I be holy? So nonetheless, that's what the Torah is telling us. We need to be different as well. we need to be somehow separate as well. Now, going back to try to identify what Kedoshim is, I'm slightly repeating myself, but I'm going to say it a little different now. To a certain extent, all of Sefer Vayikra is the book of holiness. If I had to rename the book, I would not call it Vayikra. Vayikra is a bad name. Sorry for saying this. And the Latin, which becomes the English name, Leviticus, I don't love as well. I would call it the Sefer HaKedusha, the book of holiness. Because that's what it really is about. And therefore, even though I had the apex geographically, chronologically, Yom Kippur in the Holy of Holies, I get to a different type of apex now, Kedoshim Tiyu, which is really telling me how to take the holiness out of the Beit HaMikdash, and now this is going to be the point, and it will be remarkable, because really what I need to do now is to look what comes afterwards. How does this follow up? What's included in holiness? By the way, we're not going to know this until we get towards the end of Kedoshim. But as we start reading the verses, the first thing that's going to happen, it's going to be extremely familiar. You're going to know these concepts because you've heard them before, and you're going to tell, right away you're going to say, oh, I know exactly where I've heard them before. So it's going to say, for example, Daber Kol Bnei Yisrael Matan Kedoshim Tiyu, and so on. Ish Imov Aviv Tirau Ve'et Shabtotai Tishmaru. Right? Have reverence for your parents and guard the Sabbaths. Now, what do those two things remind you of? I mean, that's not a hard question, correct? Where did you hear these things before? We've heard them before in the Ten Commandments, the Sereta Dibrot. And as we continue, and the Midrash, by the way, Midrash Rabbah will do this for you, do all the heavy lifting for you, show you, oh, all Ten Commandments are found right here in this section. What's the last of the Ten Commandments? Lo tachmod, that you shouldn't have desire things which aren't yours. So it says, hold it, what's the correlation of that, or the corollary to that, or where is that found over here? And we'll quote the most famous verse, which is, V'haftal rech kamoch ani Hashem. Love your neighbor as yourself. So what's the inverse of not loving, of loving your neighbor? What does it mean not to love your neighbor? To be jealous of your neighbor, to desire things that your neighbor has. I mean, one of the great traits, and this goes back to Pirkei Avot, to Rabbi Lezer ben Arach, when he said that the trait that everyone should have is Ayin Tova. Sorry. He said Lev Tov. What exactly is a Lev Tov? So Lev Tov I would define as that you are happy with other people's success. There's also one of the things it says in Pirkei Avot, that Ezehu Ashir HaSameach B'chelko. Who's wealthy? Somebody. Now there's two ways to define this. One is, Sameach b'chelko, is you're happy with what you have. So the Kotzker Rebbe said, Sameach b'chelko, you're happy b'chelko. You're happy with what he has. Which means, you see somebody else has a beautiful house. You say, well, damn, you know, I wish I had a house like that. What do you say? I'm saying, not that you say it, you feel it. Wow, you know, I'm really happy this guy has a great place to live, this guy has a great car, has a great life, and so on, which means, do we really, in Hebrew, they call this lefergen. I don't know how you say this in English. Lefergen. Is that, and not just in a verbal sense, that you really feel that when other people have good things happening to them, it makes you feel good, and there's not even the slightest amount of jealousy. By the way, some of the commentaries have a hard time with this. I wrote a book together with Senator Lieberman a couple of years ago, a book on, which includes the Ten Commandments. It's a book on from Pesach to Shavuot. It has one little meditation or musing for each day of the days of the Omer. And the book's in the Beit Midrash, okay? That when I got up to he wrote some chapters, I wrote some chapters. He went through my chapters, I went through his chapters. And when I got to Lo Tach mode, and by the way, I don't necessarily remember what made the final cut on things, but one of the things that I went through was the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra says, hold it a second, but that's human nature. Human nature is we are jealous. Human nature, we see somebody else as something beautiful, we want it. And it's very hard for us. So there's actually an argument which is put forward that what does it mean to break one of the Ten Commandments of Lo Tach mode? It's not just that you're jealous or you desire it when you put a plan into motion to get it. which means you actually try to get it away from them. You try to get something from somebody. Your jealousy is so consuming that you act upon it, essentially arguing that Torah does not define the thoughts, but Torah defines actually the actions. But it's interesting, this midrash that I just now cited, that the opposite, or, sorry, that the connection to Lo Tachmod is V'Haftarech Kamocha. If you really love your neighbor as yourself, then it goes back to the other teachings that I said. You're really happy for what they have. You're not upset about it. But as I continue reading from, and it's actually, if you start to think about it, you'll realize it's in the Ten Commandments itself. The very next verse is, Al tifnua elilim, don't turn to idols. B'lei masecha lo tatsu lachem, and don't worship these, or don't make for yourself gods or molten gods. Ani Hashem elokeichem. V'chein tivzchu zevach shlemim la'Hashem, l'ritzonchem tizbachu. You should have your offerings to God, which means we very quickly went from revering parents, keeping Shabbat, to not dealing with idols. Now, that's really interesting, but it shouldn't be a surprise, because all Ten Commandments are here, which takes us back, of course, to something that we know about the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments themselves, part, and this is articulated in the Gemara, how far to take this, I don't know, and I'll tell you exactly what's troubling me, but the Gemara says that, and this is this midrash, which is more so not to be taken literally, but to be understood philosophically, that when the nations of the world heard about the Ten Commandments, they heard the first one, I am God. So they say, okay, so what's in the, right, have no other gods, okay, fine. And they start going one after the other, and all of them they felt were self-serving. Until God got to the fifth one, honor your parents. Honor your parents is honoring somebody else. It's not just honoring God. That's completely different. And then as you continue, not to murder, not to steal, not to, you know, bear false witness and so on. And then you get into all of these, which are man-to-man laws, which means it may be an overstatement, which the Ramban makes, that the first five have to do with man-to-man, and the first five are man-to-God, and the second five are man-to-man. My big question on that is sexual sins. What are they? Are they sins between man and man, or are they sins between man and God? Why do you say that?
It involves two people. Biology. Science.
And if it was man and woman, you would still say the same?
Yeah.
Okay.
Man and God.
So the Rambam very, very clearly says, in all kinds of ways, but he very clearly says it, black and white, he says it in Hilchot Teshuvah, he says it in other places as well, that all the sins, sexual sins, are all between man and God. Which is interesting, because the Ramban clearly goes against that. Don't ask me why he said it. He said it. What do you want me to do?
But
I'm just telling you what he said. Don't pick on me. I'm just the messenger. And I knew this was going to get you going. I knew it was. But the Ramban does something else which is interesting. He has 14 books, right? The Mishnah Torah, the Rambam's main book, is called the Yad HaChazakah, Yad Yud Dalid, Yud 10, Dalid is 4, 14 books. These are the 14 books. He took all of Jewish law, puts them in 14 books. One of the 14 books, and I think this goes right back to our topic, is called Kiddusha. So what does he put in the laws of Kiddusha? What's in that book? It's okay. It's a little rhetorical. I didn't actually expect anybody to raise their hand now and say, oh, I know exactly which laws the Rambam has in Kedusha. He has forbidden foods, machlot asurot. He has isurei bia, forbidden sexual relations, and the laws of shechita, how to make food, which is kosher. That's what's in Kedusha. And I can't help but suspect that the Rambam is essentially reading our parsha, or our parshiot over here. He's looking over at this area. By the way, what's interesting, it goes,
that was assuming that Kedusha of the Rambam is between man and God. Because if you do man himself, it's also been done on small.
Yeah. And not only am I assuming that, I would also advise to look in the very beginning of the Mishnah Torah when he tells you a description what each of the books are about, because he's a very interesting description over here. Now, one of the things that he says about this is that these laws of Kedusha, this book of Kedusha, it's what makes us different from non-Jews. He says that's what Kedusha is. That's his definition of what Kedusha is. And I want to now go a little bit broader so I can explain all this. But first, just to make sure that you've been following me along the way. Part of the problem of what I'm doing right now is I'm doing a broader tapestry and trying to see a bigger picture. I'm actually looking at maybe even half of the book of Vayikra, and that's probably the case, so maybe even more than that, maybe even two-thirds of it. It's actually right after the sins of Nadan Avihu, and you can obviously argue that that's the catalyst. One of the most remarkable commentaries, which I'm afraid to say, but I've said it enough times already, is something which is found in the Sforno. And he notes what we've just now noted, you know, what happens after the sins of... So he said that after the sin of the golden calf, we needed more holiness. By the way, this is a very frightening thought, that when we sin, we need more holiness. I'm not talking about individually, even. I'm talking about as a nation. So he said that the price to pay for the sin of the golden calf were all the laws of Nida and all the laws of kosher. And he clearly implies that had we not sinned with the golden calf, we would have been innate holy vessels for God to be within us. But because we sinned, we lost that innate holiness. We needed to create new holiness, a new type of holiness, and therefore at this point God introduces new laws because we have become spiritually corrupt and now we need a new level of holiness. And essentially, he has a theory which goes throughout his commentary of the Torah from the very beginning, from Adam onwards, that whenever there is sin, sin is met with new laws. Why new laws? Because something was corrupted and now we need to create another veneer of holiness because we lost so much beforehand. Now, could we argue with this concept? Absolutely. But it's fascinating what he's saying. He's saying if we didn't sin with the golden calf, God would be within us. By the way, did you even need a Mishkan then? Maybe even not. Maybe everything looks different because we become the holy vessels. God is within us. But when we sin, we've become corrupted. Now we need more holiness. So then God creates other levels of holiness. So again, I'm mentioning this because I find it fascinating. I'm not necessarily saying that it's the only way of looking at it because I don't think so. But what you're saying is that we live in a generation where so many people search for stricter and stricter ways where people are looking for more and more holiness, that maybe that's a part of the dynamic. And again, sometimes people do this on a psychological level. But if we look at Kedoshim itself for a moment, be holy, and then what does it do? It then restates the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments themselves are this fascinating interaction between man to man and man to God. You want a microcosm of that? Microcosm was in one verse. What was the one verse? Revere your parents, and I'm going to add one word, but keep the Shabbat. It didn't say that. Didn't say but. It said, revere your parents, keep the Shabbat. Chazal read it, the rabbis read it, revere your parents, but keep the Shabbat. What happens if your parents, by the way, anybody who becomes a Baal Tshuva, there's like this automatic angel, bad angel, sent from heaven, tells the parents, oh, they became a Baal Tshuva, they don't want to become religious. Every single parent will then say to their kid, oh, you want to become religious, you got to listen to the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments is to honor your parents, and I'm telling you not to keep Shabbat. It happens so many times that I'm not exaggerating, but that's exactly what this verse says. Revere your parents, but keep the Shabbat. Honor your parents, be respectful of your parents, but if they tell you to break Shabbat, so that's something that you can't do. You can honor them in all kinds of ways, but you can't break Shabbat. But what's interesting about this is it does bring about this tension between man to man and man to God. But I want to go back to this tension and say this a little bit in a broader way. Three of my books are published with a publisher which is called Kodesh Press. So the reason it's called Kodesh Press is the guy who opened up the press, Rabbi Goldstein, he loves this concept of Kodesh, of holiness. He actually wrote a book called Holiness, which is published by Kodesh Press, which I guess is quite appropriate. I had a discussion with him last week regarding a particular point. And I want to use the different sections that we've learned about today and try to put them together, but put them together and create a tension. Let me explain to you what I mean. I just now, in a microcosm, did one. What was that? Honor your parents, keep the Shabbat. So when it comes down to it, what does Judaism value more? Does Judaism value more the laws which are between man and man, or does it value more the ritual, the laws which are between man and God? So first let me say something which I hope is obvious. What if you have an individual who gets up every morning, he or she, and they pray with great devotion? If I'll embellish it, at least on a male side, in a more normative sense, goes to shul, puts on his talit, puts on his tefillin, and prays, and doesn't talk during, and really prays with great devotion, and he means it, he means every word that he says. Takes off his talit, takes off his tefillin, kisses it, puts it away, takes the talit, folds it, carefully puts it away, and then goes out to business, and in business the man is an animal. And the man, you know, cuts corners, and the man is terrible to his employees, and the man is terrible in the way that he does, but business is business. Which means somebody who succeeds in creating a absolute, complete division, where he's able to decompartmentalize his religious life and then his real life, there's something wrong about that. The individual who's able to have all their religion in shul, there's something wrong. I mean, in a certain sense, when we teach that the synagogue is the center of Jewish life, we're doing something terrible when we say this. Right? Do you all realize this? There's something, by the way, very Catholic. And it's very Catholic as well. Because you say the church is the center of religious life, but it's not the center of life. And when we do the same thing and we say, oh, the shul is the center of religious life, and what about the other 23 hours a day, or maybe other 6 days a week, or maybe even most of the year that you're not in the synagogue, you're not in the shul, so then I have no religious responsibilities, or even worse, I have no religious identity when I'm not in shul? Which means, did Judaism ever believe this point, that a building is the center? Now again, you could say geographically it's the center, but it can't be the total identity in terms of religion, can't only be localized in a building. So I'm going to try to say the same thing again right now. If a person plays with great devotion, and then they're terrible people outside, I know you want to call them hypocrites. I'm not sure if I want to call them a hypocrite, but I will call them superficial. And I'll call them, as a Jew, I'll call them an only partial success. They partially succeed, or they succeeded in one particular area, but these other areas need to have success as well. And the Jew whose entire religious identity is only while they're in the shul, and outside of the shul there's no religious identity, I hope all of you recognize there's something wrong with that. Now, on a certain level, that's what Parshat Kedoshim is screaming about. And it really is screaming. And you just have to follow the verse. It's verse after verse after verse. And be holy, and now here's all these things that you need to do. Which means it's not just v'haftarach kamocha. V'haftarach kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, is perhaps the apex, but it's certainly not there by itself. There are a number of things that speak about stealing, not to take something, not to withhold the wages. Again, that's actually part of the point I was just now making. Don't swear falsely in my name. Don't desecrate God's name, therefore. Don't abuse your neighbor. Don't steal. Don't withhold the wages of somebody. You owe somebody money, don't hold back the money. You have to pay them. Lo tekalel cheresh. Don't curse somebody who's deaf. And of course, you can all say, but he's deaf. He's not going to hear anyway. It doesn't make a difference. It's a human being. They have dignity. Lufnei iva lo teiten michsho. Don't put a stumbling block in front of somebody who's blind. V'yareitim elokecha. Okay, maybe nobody will know. God will know. Have fear of God. Lo taso avol b'mishpat. Don't cause a miscarriage of justice. Lo tisa p'nei dol. Don't lift somebody up just because they're low. V'lo tadar p'nei gadol. And don't give somebody added honor just because they're great. But tzedek tishpod amitecha. Rather, treat all people, judge all people fairly. Lo tilech rechil ba'amecha. Don't go around as a gossip monger, going around from person to person telling people things. Lo tamar al dam reyecha. Don't stand in your brother's blood, ani Hashem. Lo tisna tachicha bilbavecha. Don't hate your brother in your heart. Hocheach tochiach tamitecha. If they've messed up, rebuke them, point out, tell them where they've done something wrong. V'lo tisav alechei. Don't cause them to keep on sinning. Lo tikam v'lo titor b'nei mecha. Don't bear a grudge. Don't take revenge against people in your nation. And only then does it say, v'haftar l'rayecha kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. And adds two more words which are essential. Ani Hashem. I am God. which means when you read, and it's beautiful, this whole section is beautiful, and it's talking about a life which is, and that's what I want to stress, this is holiness. This is a holy nice life. And now you can, of course, tell me, but what are you talking about? This is just decency. Well, it's not just decency. This is what holiness is to take those values outside of the Beit HaMikdash. Again, starting with Yom Kippurim over here, take it outside of the Beit HaMikdash and have it apply in all kinds of cases. The next verse, of course, is quite problematic. Et chukotai tishmoru, follow all of my chukim. And a chok is the very opposite of what we've been talking about till now. A chok is something, generally, which we don't understand the meaning of. Lo tabir kalayim, don't misuck the species. Sat chalotu to kalayim, uveged kalayim, shatnez lo yalecha. And don't wear clothing which has wool and linen which are weaved together. Now, what was the point that I discussed with this Rabbi Goldstein recently? Rabbi Soloveitchik once said, and this goes back to a talk that he gave that I only heard recorded because I think it was around 1962 or so. He said, okay, let's try to evaluate what's more important in Judaism, ritual, the man to God, or man to, or interpersonal in terms of how we treat other people. So he said, let's take an example. The fundamental, or even leave fundamental, I use the word apex before in terms of interpersonal, patriarch kamocha, the apex in terms of the ritual would be the ritual of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, right? Yom Kippurim. That would be the holiest day of the year when he goes into the Holy of Holies, and that's the most important ritual of the year. So, when it comes to interpersonal laws, there's all kinds of interpersonal laws. So he set up the following dramatic case, which is a slight embellishment of a Gemara. Let's say the Kohen Gadol, an heir of Yom Kippur, now by the way, in terms of the halakha, he's supposed to be sequestered in the Beit HaMikdash in the days leading up to Yom Kippur. But let's say he gets out, he goes for a little stroll, he needs some fresh air, and there he comes upon a dead body. Now, in Torah law, this is called a mate mitzvah. Because of human dignity, you don't leave a dead body laying on the streets. You need to make sure that that body will have burial. So you find a body someplace in a forest. You need to pick up that body and carry it out and make sure it has proper burial. But what if that person is a Kohen? A Kohen's not allowed to touch a dead body. Well, Kohen can if it's a mate mitzvah. What if it's the Kohen Gadol? Same thing. Kohen Gadol is obligated because it's a mate mitzvah. So he said, look at this case, and here's where he embellished a little bit. He goes, what, and again, this is an embellishment. He goes, what kind of person dies and nobody's looking for them? He goes, it was probably a homeless person. He goes, the word he actually used was a hobo. I guess, I don't know how often that word is used today. He said, it was a bum, a hobo, a drunk, somebody who society has forgotten about, which means in his embellishment then, you have the hero of Yom Kippur, the most important Jew in the world right now on this day, is going to be the Kohen Gadol, and then you have this forgotten person whose sense of dignity is completely evaporated because they're dead. It's not, you know, there's certain people who maybe walk around in life and don't conduct themselves in the greatest way, and therefore their sense of dignity sometimes is compromised. Maybe they feel it, maybe they don't. This person doesn't feel it. Again, I would think that somebody who's on the street, homeless, living on the street, and they've been living in this way, which is really an affront to human dignity, but maybe they've become used to it. Maybe not. But this person's dead. There's no affront anymore. So if I talk about the key in terms of, and there's a very strong point to this, and I could defend this. When you look at the laws of tzedakah, for example, the laws of tzedakah, I think, are directly correlated to human dignity. One of the lower levels of tzedakah is that I see somebody who's poor, I hand them money. It's a nice thing to do, but there are higher levels. So why are there higher levels? So let's say I don't know who I'm giving it to. That's a higher level. Why? Because the person who received the money knows that the person who gave it has no idea who it went to. And next time they see me, they're able to retain more dignity. Let's say the person receiving it has no idea where it came from. And the person giving it has no idea. Everything is done secretly, arranged. So again, there's more dignity, which is the person who received it now can feel comfortable with everybody else. Because nobody knows where it came from. But the highest level of tzedakah, the Rambam stresses, what's the highest level? The highest level of tzedakah is to give somebody a job. Now, why is that the highest level? Because there's the most amount of dignity which is retained, or maybe even established. Because then I'm turning to this person, not saying, listen, I know you need a little money, here, take some money. But rather, it's saying to somebody, I need you. You have something to contribute. You have something to give. Which means the laws of tzedakah, and I'm going to say this broader, the laws of interpersonal relationships are based upon human dignity. And the more that somebody is able to retain human dignity, or the more we're able to give them dignity, so therefore the more acute that law is. Which goes back to the dramatic case over here. Kohen Gadol, all the hopes of the Jewish people to achieve atonement, when he goes and does the Avodah, and he's prepared and he's poised to do this. And on the other hand, there is this homeless, dead body who has no sense of dignity. Nonetheless, Jewish law would dictate that the Kohen Gadol has to make himself impure, pick up the body, and bring this person for burial. So now, is this just one particular case, or does this indicate a principle? Rabbi Soloveitchik felt it indicated a principle. If you're interested, I can show you tshuva from Rav Ovadia, who's not convinced that it's a principle, and maybe goes more to a case by case, but Rabbi Soloveitchik felt philosophically this is a principle that when it comes down to it, when I have a tension between ritual versus interpersonal, I go to the interpersonal. By the way, that doesn't mean I can take much of Jewish law and throw it away, that somebody is hungry, right? I can then give them non-kosher food because they're hungry. No, if they're dying, it's one thing. But just because somebody's hungry, it's not that interpersonal wins over ritual in every single application of law. I still need parameters, but he still nonetheless felt that this is an indication of something which is greater. But by the way, just realize what all this is telling us. It's not that holiness isn't important. Rather, it's the opposite. It's that holiness is manifest in different ways. I want to read something which I think is really what's going to be essential in terms of the conclusion of this. Towards the very end of Parashat Kedoshim, there is a... God tells Moshe the following. Ushmartim et kol chukotai. Follow all of the laws that I give you. V'kol mishpotai. Again, the general understanding, not everyone, but the general understanding is chok is something which I would not have created on my own. The mishpat is something which I would have created on my own. V'asitim otam. V'lo taki etchem ha'aretz asher ani mevi etchem shama lashevet ba. So this is something I've been avoiding the whole time. But it's this other sense of what holiness is about. And it is the direction of the last third of the book of Vayikra. It's that holiness is needed in our lives. I'm going to go back to the Beit HaMikdash again. Part of the service of Yom Kippur, Yom Kippurim, is to bring about atonement for misusing that which is holy, for making the Beit Midrash not holy. Part of our atonement needs to also be for doing things to ourselves that we have not utilized, our intellect, our bodies, that we've made ourselves less holy than we could or we should be. That's part of the process. It's not just I did this, it's that I didn't do what I could have. I did not achieve the holiness. But all of this goes to a direction which becomes very obvious. And I'll say it's obvious if you want, I'll give you homework. Read through, I would say, read through chapters 10 through the end of the book of Vayikra. Just read it straight, the whole thing. And I know you're looking at me like I'm crazy, but to prepare for today, I did this around three times. Okay, not once, not twice, three times. And I knew most of it before. Because there is a very simple message over here, and that's what we can lose in all of this. I want to go back a step. What exactly does the word pshat mean? What is pshat? So the joke about pshat is what I think it means, and anything else is not pshat. Okay, that's a joke. It's not serious. What?
It depends on the century.
I'll tell you what pshat is. Pshat is a contextual understanding of the text, and the only question is, how broad are you going to make your context? So I'm going to now say, if you're going to try to understand the concept of holiness by reading half of the book of Vayikra, you're going to come up with a very clear understanding about what this is really all about. And the issue is that it's not just about us as individuals. It's not just about the shul. It's not just about the community. It's about the nation of Israel. And it's eventually about the land of Israel. Because all of the laws of holiness over here, the context is, yes, you shall be holy. I'm not going to say you need to love your neighbor as yourself when you're in Israel. But if you're not in Israel, it doesn't make a difference. But I will say that the opposite is true. I mentioned the Kutzker Rebbe before. The Kutzker Rebbe had a grandson who wrote a book about a totally Zionist book, which got him into lots of trouble because that type of chassidim, we're not supposed to write Zionist books. And one of the things that he wrote was that before a Jew makes a decision to come and live in Israel, they need to consciously accept upon themselves that they will love all Jews as themselves. And by the way, he writes clearly, he goes, Ashkenazim and Sfaradim, religious, not, all of us need to decide that we're going to live together in peace and harmony, otherwise you can't come and live here. It's actually an extension of something which is found in the Magen Avraham, which is written in Arachayim, which some Sidurim have it, which is from the Arizal. The Arizal says, before you pray in the morning, you need to say that I accept upon myself a Haftarach Kamocha. Now go back to the case I gave you before. The person who comes to shul, prays with great devotion, and goes out and abuses other people. The Arizal said, before you pray, you need to take upon yourself that you're going to love your neighbor as yourself. If you don't do that, you can't pray. What's the Arizal trying to do? He's trying to merge together these two aspects, and I'm going to say it again, these two aspects of holiness. It's the aspect of holiness in terms of the devotion as we pray and serve God and learn Torah and so on, but there's another aspect of devotion, and that is the interpersonal, how I treat people. Now, again, I could have stopped there if I were not an insane Zionist, and it was a week after Yom Ha'atzma'ut. Or if I wouldn't have actually read what it says in Vayikra. The whole context over here is about the land itself is holy. It says this on multiple occasions. You need to keep kosher, because if you don't keep kosher, you're going to cause this impurity to come within you. The land of Israel is a sensitive land, and it's constitution is such that it cannot accept unholiness. There was a great Kabbalist, Avram Azulay, who said that if you look at people and they live in Israel, then you have to know that they're holy, because otherwise the land would have vomited them out. So next time you see somebody, you think, oh, what kind of terrible person this is. They must be holy, because that's it's a spiritual truth that this land only accepts holy people. Kacha Katuv. And his commentary to the Zohar, he writes this. But this doesn't. Don't say. The problem is that you don't. That you're a rationalist. That's the first problem. The second problem is he's telling you what your orientation should be. This is attitudinal, right? This is attitudinal. In terms of attitude, this is how you need to look at people. Whether God has a different cheshbon and is waiting, you know, for the next boat out, that's another question. That's not your problem. But right now they're here, so he says that's the default. The default is you have to assume such a thing. So what did the Kutzker Rebbe said? He said in a sense, you want to deserve to live here, you have to decide that you're going to be keeping all the interpersonal laws. Otherwise, the land can't accept you. It's not going to work. But that's really the subtext of everything which is taking place in this section, because it keeps coming back to it again and again. It says it very specifically in terms of all the sexual laws, which is why, again, the Rambam sees this in terms of Kedusha. It says that that the nations that were here before you did not keep these laws, and therefore they were vomited out. And that's the term that comes again and again. We move from here, and again, I don't want to ruin the whole book for you. We go to Emor, we go to Bahar, we go to Emor, Bahar, Bichol Kotai. It becomes totally land-centric. Emor goes through the holidays again, but in terms of the agricultural identity of the holidays. We get to Bahar, it talks about Shemitah and Yovel. It talks about the agricultural laws. We get to Bichol Kotai, it says, this is what's going to happen if you sin and mess up, you're going to be kicked out of the land. Which means something happened over here along the way that you didn't notice as it was happening. I'm just telling you, it was here. And it may have missed us, but it's not just the tension between the ritual and the interpersonal. There's this whole other aspect to it. And don't get fooled into thinking, oh, We have a thing which is holy, which is the Beit HaMikdash, which is the Mishkan, and that is the whole Yom Kippur, the Holy of Holies, and so on, the Kohen Gadol. There's this whole other aspect of holiness. Now let me read the last couple of verses in Vayikra, and you're going to see what I've been saying is very, very clear. One second, I don't know how far back to start. This ends with all the sexual laws. The last one was a brother should not take his brother's wife. It says this is a problem, and then it ends. Ushmartim et kol chukotai. Keep all of the laws, even if they don't make sense. Ve mishpot et kol mishpotai, and all of the legal aspects. Vasitim otam, and do them. Ve'lo taki etchem haaretz asher anim avim etchem shama l'shevet ba. And don't do things which will cause the land to vomit you out. And don't follow the illogical laws which are done by the nations I'm kicking out. Because they did all of these things, and that's why they've been chased away. And I've said, you're going to inherit their land. And I'm giving this to you to inherit them, a land which flows with milk and honey. I am God who's made you different from the nations. This, by the way, is the verse the Rambam quotes in his introduction to the book of Kedusha. I've made you different. V'yivdalti bein ha-behema ha-torah l'tmeya, u'bein ha-of ha-tamei l'tahor, v'lo tishaktsu et nafshatechem b'yomot uva'of v'chol asher tirmos ha-adama shivdalti lachem l'tamei. Which is fascinating, because now we only realize that the second half of Shmini that spoke about the animals, that was the introduction to the whole section of Kedusha, that was the introduction to how in the world you're going to be able to remain in the land. That the land of Israel will not let you be here unless you've achieved holiness. And this followed right after all the laws of the sexual behaviors, which what got the Rambam to write in his book of Kedusha, these particular areas. Ve'yitem li kadoshim. And now how does it end? And you should be holy for me. Ki kadosh ani Hashem. Va'avdil etchem min ha'amim liot li. And that's why the Rambam felt that what is holiness? Holiness are the things that make us different from the nations around us. Ve'ishush, okay. There's one more verse, but I'm not going to get into that verse. It will take me far afield. Which means what we have in front of us over here, again, it's very broad. It's interpersonal, how we treat one another. It's between man and God. But there's this whole other element to it, what holiness is really all about. And that's much more on a national level. It's a national level because it's this land that we're supposed to live in, which means we're not just a religious community. We're not just a religion. We're something which is much stronger than this. I want to end with a story. Yeah, you had one more comment? Well, you're done. Okay. I once knew a very great rabbi, and I will define for you what a great rabbi is. His name was Rabbi Noach Weinberg, and I'll tell you what made him great. What made him great was there are certain people who are great rabbis because they care greatly about their students. I really hope that all of your teachers are like that, and I believe they are, and I believe they're great in that way. But then there are people who care not just about their students, they care about other people's students. And then there are people who care not just about other people's students, they care about every single Jew in this world. And that's what Rav Noach was like. Rav Noach was the one who founded the yeshiva of Eish HaTorah. So I worked for him for a number of years. I learned with him. We learned b'chavruta a bit. And he had a story that he loved to tell. So in his memory, I'll tell over the story. Maybe you heard it, maybe you haven't. But it goes to the very heart of this week's parsha. The story is found in the Yalkut Yalkut Mamloes. It's found also in one other midrash. Quite obscure. But this is what it says. It says, once upon a time, there were two friends. And they were friends, they grew up as friends. Any of you had a best friend when you were a kid, and you swore you'd always be best friends, and you haven't seen them now, and they're 10 years, 15 years, and you've lost contact? So he said that once there were these two friends, they were best friends, and they said, no, we'll always be friends, we'll always be there for one another, but they lost contact. And one ended up moving away. But as would often happen, is one lived on one side of a border, the other side of the border, and these two countries ended up being at war with one another. And what eventually happened is that one of the friends was on a business trip, and he gets caught by the other country, and he gets put on trial. Now, the only thing he was really guilty of was being a citizen of a different country, a country that they were at war with, and then they decided to try him and to put him to death for being from this other country. So the judge listens to all the evidence and then finds him guilty and says, you're going to be put to death. So he says, do you have any last, you know, requests? He says, yeah, just one. He said, I understand that you feel you have to kill me. I understand you feel I've broken your laws. But if I die right now, you're really sentencing me to something much worse, because my family has no idea where all of my assets are, who owes me money, where the money is, and so on. So what you're going to do is you're actually sentencing my family to poverty. So the judge says, okay, what do you suggest? I mean, sounded a little more interesting than the average trial. He said, simple, give me a date to come back. Let me go to my family. I'll say goodbye. I'll get all my affairs in order, and then I'll come back and you kill me. And the judge started laughing, of course. And he said, okay, so what collateral are you going to give me to make sure that you come back? Because, you know, the judge was essentially saying to himself, there's no way you're coming back. I let you go. I'm like, what do you think, I'm an idiot? So he says, oh, what guarantee are you going to give me? So he said, well, the truth is, there's a guy that I grew up with who was my best friend as a kid who lives in this city, and I'm sure that he'd be happy to take my place and give the guarantee. And if I don't come back, you'll kill him. And he's my best friend. I obviously wouldn't want that to happen. So the judge thought this was the funniest thing he ever heard. So he said, let's find the friend. Go find the friend. They hadn't seen in other years. And the judge says, listen, we found him guilty. We're putting him to death. He needs to be back in 30 days. And he says that if you're willing to sit and take his place in prison, and if he doesn't come back, we'll kill you instead. So are you willing to do it? So the friend says, sure. Like, what are friends for? I trust him. He says he'll be back. He'll be back. He's my friend. I mean, yeah. I believe 100% he'll be back. So they set a date. The execution will take place 30 days, 12 noon. And this became something which was fascinating for people. You know, will he be back? Will he not be back? You know, I'm sure there's a lot of betting going down on this. You probably get 2-1 odds that he's not coming back. Anyway, the day comes. Guy's not back. 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 11:45, he's not back. So they go to the judge. What do? Say, take the friend out and kill him. So they take the friend out. 12 o'clock, they take him out. And you know, lots of people come around, and they put a guillotine. They're about to kill him. And then they hear somebody screaming, stop. And they look around. The guy's back. At this point, it's 12:15, and he comes over to the judge. He said, I said I'll be back. I'm back. Let him go. And the friend who's about to be killed said, not so quick. We made a deal. The deal was you have to be back by 12. You got back late, so they kill me. And the other says, no, but I'm the one who they found guilty. They kill me. And the two of them are going back and forth. No, they kill me. They kill me. And now the judge has no idea what to do. Meanwhile, the king had taken interest in this whole story because he also thought it was really fascinating. And the king says, have them both. I want to meet both of them. So they both come in, and they both are still yelling back and forth, you know, you have to kill me, you have to kill me. And they both present their cases to the king. He said, listen, I was found guilty. I was the one who broke your laws. You have to kill me. And the other one says, we made a deal. He had to be back by 12. He wasn't back by 12. You have to kill me. And the judge says to the two of them, shut up. I'm not going to kill either one of you on one condition. And they said, what's that condition? And he says, that I can be your third friend. And the Midrash then ends, and it says, that's what the Pasuk means. V'yahavta l'reacha kamocha ani Hashem. If you love one another as yourself, God says, I'll be your third friend.